My guest today, Professor Mazen Kumsia, has a long history of working for justice in Palestine, both in the United States as well as in his native land. Having taught genetics at Yale, Duke, and Tennessee universities, he gave up his formal academic career in the U.S. to continue his work for Palestine from his birthplace in Bethlehem. From there, along with his nonviolent activism, he teaches and does research at Bethlehem and Beerzeit universities. He has published hundreds of articles and several books, including Mammals of the Holy Land, Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights in Israel, Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, and Popular Resistance in Palestine, History of Pope and Empowerment, both of which have been translated to a number of languages. He also has an activism book and published electronically on his website, which is Kumsia, Kumsieh.org. His work has also attracted the attention of the Anti-Defamation League, which notes on its site that, quote, as a major proponent of divestment from Israel, Kumsia regularly writes on the subject and keeps an up-to-date list of divestment and boycott campaigns on his website, linking to the organization and institutions behind them. In January 2006, Kumsia's article, Boycott Israel, appeared in Global Agenda, the official magazine of the World Economic Forum in Davos. In the article, Kumsia implored countries to divest from Israel and impose a boycott. Welcome once again, Mazen Kumsia, to Takes on the World.
Hello, thank you for having me on your show.
I'm really glad to have you back, and I'm always glad to get your emails, your reports from occupied Palestine. You know, eight years after your article made it to the Davos Forum, the Boycott Israel movement has taken off internationally, and particularly in Europe, where it's being seen as putting pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel to make some kind of accommodation with the Palestinian Authority and the current, for want of a better term, negotiations with Israel. How are those talks being viewed by Palestinians on the ground, who will be the people most immediately affected by their results?
Well, the Palestinians here in the West Bank, at least, a majority of them, at least, the ones I interact with, are greeting these discussions between Tzipi Livni and the Palestinian negotiators with a big yawn, basically. Most Palestinians don't view them as anything that something positive could come out of. Those who are concerned about them or watch them are more concerned about their negative outcome than about potential positive outcome. And by that I mean that people are worried about what Kerry and his Israeli patrons are going to foist on the Palestinians in terms of the structure of an agreement that will solidify occupation and strengthen Israeli position and strengthen Israeli apartheid.
There has been a lot of discussion about what will be the status of the Jordan Valley, which Israel wants to maintain military control of. Mahmoud Abbas, he's called president, but he has his term expired in 2009, has said at one point he wants U.S. NATO troops there, like, indefinitely. Then he says he'll accept Israeli troops there from 3, and then he extends it to 5 years. This, in a sense, would extend the occupation almost indefinitely, but give some legitimacy, or at least in Abbas's eyes or Washington's eyes, some legitimacy with the Palestinian people if some kind of agreement signed that gives puts a state of Palestine, in fact, into existence. But from what you say and from what I've seen, the likelihood of any kind of just solution doesn't exist.
Not in this kind of atmosphere. We have a very uneven situation here. Israel is a colonizing, occupying power with nuclear, chemical, biological weapons. It is getting billions of dollars of American taxpayer money. And it is a country that is supported by the U.S. president and Congress because of the presence of a very strong Israeli lobby. This lobby has pushed the U.S. into wars like the war in Iraq, which cost the U.S. $3 trillion and thousands of American lives. This is a country that flaunts its power in Congress to achieve results that are contrary to U.S. national interests and to the U.S. public interest. This is a country that, that basically feels empowered now, and they don't feel they have any reason to give up anything, with the exception, as you said earlier, or alluded to earlier, the issue of boycotts, boycott, divestment, sanctions, which are starting to whittle away at this this military and economic might of this apartheid regime.
Well, certainly the European movement, unlike the American movement, targets Israel itself. And so we've seen a situation where a number of national banks in Norway, the Netherlands, have stopped doing business with Israeli banks that have businesses that do have branches in the occupied territories. And there are a number of Israeli businessmen who are more, less concerned with the occupation than their bottom line, it seemed to be, saying that there has to be some kind of a deal made that, in appearances' sake, would resolve the problem, if in fact it won't. And I know in 2006, when you wrote that article that was published at Davos, that was a major breakthrough. And now we see the situation, as I say, putting pressure that the Israelis are now being concerned about that. Most recently, we had the situation with conflict over Soda Stream, in which Scarlett Johansson, whose mother is Jewish, and has been a volunteer for Oxfam, a spokesperson for Oxfam for 8 years, suddenly found she could make some money by plugging SodaStream on an ad in the Super Bowl. And this started a call for her not to do this, and she decided she would choose Super SodaStream over Oxfam. But the owner of Oxfam made the argument, which was published in the American media, that in fact SodaStream is a positive example of Palestinian workers are allowed to work there and they get the same wages of as do Israelis. What's your comment on that?
Well, I mean, it's the same kind of argument that the white minority government in apartheid South Africa used. They said you cannot engage in boycott, divestment, sanctions because it will hurt the black workers in the gold mines and diamond mines in South Africa. That if the economy suffers, that the blacks who are employed will suffer. Well, the answer came, of course, from leadership of the African National Congress, Pan-African Congress, and people like Desmond Tutu and the unions, who said, no, we are for a boycott. We are for a boycott because the situation is an apartheid situation, that we are forced to have jobs, menial jobs, in Israeli settlements or Israeli colonies or in these factories that are built on stolen Palestinian land, like SodaStream factories on a stolen Palestinian land. We are forced to work there so that we can live and eat. Does not mean that we are against a boycott of these factories and of these entities, because what we want is freedom. What we want is for justice to prevail. We're not interested in very short-term maintenance of a slave-master relationship where the slave maybe gets to eat and maybe not.
I would assume also that the Palestinians who came to work at the SodaStream factory had to go through checkpoints in, before being allowed to enter the city that they built, Mahal Abumim, something Israelis would not have to go through.
Of course not. We have here a system of apartheid. We have apartheid at every level of our society. We have transportation apartheid. We have educational apartheid. We have religious apartheid. We have water apartheid, even, where the Israelis get many times more water per capita than we get, even though it's our own water. And when the Martin Schulz just mentioned this system of inequality in water distribution in the Knesset, the Minister of Economy of the State of Israel walked out on his speech and said that he is lying. Well, no, Martin Schulz was not lying when he mentioned that there's inequality in water distribution. In fact, the World Bank issued the report, and the World Bank is certainly not a people-friendly institution, issued a report that said there's war inequality here and there's other kinds of discriminatory measures. So Israel is a discriminatory, racist state. Everybody recognizes that. All the human rights organizations in the world have recognized that, even Israeli human rights organizations. And for people to continue to imagine that just because Palestinian workers work in an Israeli settlement or even work to build the wall that is isolating their houses from their lands, that this is somehow justification for continuing this system. To me, that's an oxymoron. That's a contradictory to basic humanity or basic principles of justice.
Before I called you in my introductory remarks, I mentioned that this is a kind of a loaded deck in the negotiations because everybody seems to be on one side. We have the Israeli negotiators, Livni and her lawyer, and then you have Saeb Erekat, who several years ago was revealed in Al Jazeera. He was ready to make all kinds of promises to the Israel to get some kind of a deal, and that he resigned from his being the negotiator. Suddenly he reappears, and there's this image is that there's some kind of contest going on. The Americans who were representing ostensibly the United States, Martin Indyk and David Makovsky, who are arranging a so-called framework, of course, longtime AIPAC and Israeli lobbyists. And so it's like a one-sided operation, and there's nobody representing the Palestinians. I mentioned earlier in my show, does anyone speak for Palestine? I said, you do, because no one certainly in the Palestinian Authority does, and the world seems just let this thing go on, even though Abbas has not had an election and his term expired in 2009. Does he have any legitimacy among any sizable segment of the population?
Well, the Palestinian Authority is a unique creation. It came about, actually, its genesis, I traced it back to 1968 with an Israeli plan that was co-authored. The chairman of the committee that created this plan was General Alon. And the Alon plan basically called for the creation of a self-ruling authority here by the Palestinians so that basically the Palestinians provide security for the Israelis. They rule over other Palestinians so that instead of Israeli soldiers or police beating Palestinian demonstrators, it would be Palestinian security or police beating Palestinian demonstrators. This was the 1968 plan. It changed a couple of times, but its essence stayed the same. It changed, for example, with the what's called the Village Leagues in the 1970s that Israel tried to implement on us. And then came the Bean Plan of 1988, which was essentially the same, autonomy for the Palestinians but no sovereignty. And then this morphed into the so-called Oslo process. The Oslo process, which was basically an Israeli plan that the Palestinians accepted in Norway, hence it's called the Oslo process, the Palestinian leadership of Abu Mazen and others have accepted it. This process is basically enslavement of the Palestinians and continuation of the occupation with a Palestinian face to it in terms of administering those areas, the autonomous areas like Bethlehem or Ramallah or Gaza. When one understands the genesis of this, it has always been an Israeli Zionist plan. It has never been a Palestinian plan. It's not a PLO program. It's not anybody else's program. It's a Zionist program. And the U.S. to adopt it and push it, this is something that then becomes understandable, that you create people who will act as subcontractors for the occupation, basically. And that's what we have here. In South Africa, there were similar situations with Zululand and Chief Buthelezi and his his police, which secured the black community in Zululand, basically, against the the people like in the African National Congress or Pan-African Congress or others.
That history is very important, because then I've compared actually the Palestinian Authority and its militia with that of the Vichy regime under the Nazis, in which their job was not to protect the people of France, but to protect the occupiers. And certainly we constantly read of Israeli soldiers going into villages in the middle of the night, arresting or killing so-called targeted suspects, and there's no Palestinian militia around to protect them. And then I quoted Ephraim Snay, the former defense minister, who said that it isn't generally discussed in public, but the cooperation between the security services of Israel and those of the Palestinian Authority work very well to Israel's satisfaction, which is a very sad commentary. And obviously, what you're saying, if there would be a deal made that would put Abbas in a Buthelezi position, the job of the Palestinian Authority militia, Palestinian army or militia, would be to control the population.
Well, that's what they are doing now, basically, is trying to control the population. The problem with this, I mean, I don't want to emphasize too much the negative aspects. What the Zionists face is that basically you cannot keep millions of people under occupation with whatever face you choose continuously and hope for the best. Eventually, people rise up. And I wrote a book about nonviolent popular resistance in Palestine, and I counted 14 uprisings that we had since the late 19th century with the first Zionist colony in Palestine. And so uprisings come and go, and on average, about every 10 years, we have an uprising. And we are now in the beginning of a new uprising. In the next year or two, it will intensify here. And it doesn't matter that they have arrangements or even if Abu Mazen, you know, God forbid, signs whatever document he chooses to sign, if this document forfeits Palestinian rights, foremost of these rights are the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands, this will not bring any kind of stability to the situation, let alone peace. If anything, it would lead to further destabilize the situation and to accelerating the uprising, which will happen, and eventually Palestinians will get their freedom. We will get our freedom, with or without Abu Mazen, with or without Netanyahu, with or without the help of Kerry and Obama, or their hindrance or their activities, which is intended to liquidate the Palestinian cause. It will not succeed. We will have our freedom. People yearn for freedom, and they need freedom, and that brings peace and justice.
Well, that is the positive outlook, and it's something they're not taking into consideration. By the way, I should say you use the term Abu Mazen, and that was his what they call a military name in Fatah. Is that how the people refer to him usually in Palestine, as Abu Mazen still?
Yes, it is kind of a common term for him. In Palestinian culture, we also name the person after his oldest son, and his oldest son, his name is Mazen, so we call him Father of Mazen, Abu Mazen.
In any case, one of you mentioned the question, the right of return of the refugees, which is not on the table at all in these negotiations. What I find interesting is there is a discussion as a way to get the Israeli public, or a certain segment of the Israeli public, the Middle Eastern Jews, the Mizrahim, whose origins were in Middle Eastern countries and who left or were forced out from those countries after the formation of the state up to the Six-Day War, and were welcomed by Israel. Matter of fact, Israel sent planes to Yemen and to Iraq to bring Jews from Arab lands to Israel. They're talking about them being compensated for the losses that they suffered by leaving their homes in Iraq, Yemen, Morocco, Algeria, and so on. And this obviously would be paid for by the United States. But the idea of compensating the refugees in the camps of Lebanon, of Jordan, and the ones under fire in Yarmouk camp in Syria obviously aren't on the table. Have you commented on that?
I'm sorry, but there's no equivalency between Jews who lived in Arab countries and the Palestinian refugees. It is almost like saying the argument that Europeans who came to North America and destroyed the native culture in North America and drove the natives into the reservations are refugees from Europe who should be equivalent to the Native Americans. No, they're not equivalent to the Native Americans. They are not to be compensated in equal numbers with Native Americans who would lose their rights to their homes and lands. Jews in Arab countries were minorities in those Arab countries, like Christians in Arab countries. Jews in Arab countries came to Israel mostly after 1948. Very few came before 1948 or during 1948. They came in the 1950s as a result of Zionist propaganda and other efforts that mobilized them to come to be essentially slave laborers in the new state of Israel. They used even tactics like bombing Jewish synagogues in
Baghdad,
in Iraq, and others. This is the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence services, to try and scare them into leaving their countries to come to this new state. In any case, there were minorities in those countries. They were migrants, regardless of the treatment that they suffered under, whatever regimes that they suffered under. That's not this equivalent to Palestinian refugees who lost their country, basically. And they were the majority here. We Palestinians were the majority. We were pushed out. This is different than the treatment of minorities. I'm for equal treatment of minorities in any country, and there's no difference between Jews in, let's say, Morocco or Tunisia and Jews in America or Jews in Poland or Jews in Russia. If those countries treat their minorities wrong, then we should all defend the minorities and insist that they are treated right, but that's where they belong. They belong in those countries that they lived in, and they are not considered by international law as refugees, whether they are Jews from America who came to Israel or Jews from Poland who came to Israel. They are not considered as refugees by international law. International law, on the other hand, clearly recognizes Palestinians as refugees since they were pushed out via war to leave their country, and they were ethnically cleansed even. And this is a very, very different treatment in international law and in basic human rights and justice, is that people should be treated with equality in their own country, but if they are pushed out of their country during war and ethnic cleansing, then they are refugees.
Actually, if I had referred to them as refugees, it was not my opinion that they are. In fact, in Israel, they were not considered to be refugees in even the official documents until it became a tactic to balance the demands, legitimate demands, of the Palestinians who were forced to flee ethnically cleansed to return. It was interesting. Initially, the figure of Palestinians who were forced to leave, who left, was around 750,000. Gradually, the number of Jews from Arab lands crept up from 500,000, and this was, as you say, most of them didn't. None of them came in any large number. The biggest year I remember was 128,000, and maybe 1950. But the number.
I was going to say you raised a very important point. When Israel signed the peace treaty with Egypt, for example, and the negotiations leading up to that, Israel has never demanded or recognized that there were Jewish refugees from Egypt, so to speak. They didn't say that. There were many Jews who did come from Egypt and live in the new state of Israel, But Israel did not recognize them as refugees, and they consider them as Jews who belong in Israel and who came to Israel. And as such, they did not ask Egypt for any compensation or any money or any return of those refugees to their lands. I personally think they have a right to return to Egypt, and the Egyptian government has a recognition that any person born or raised in Egypt and their children have a right to go back to Egypt if they choose to, whereas Israel refuses to recognize that the Palestinians have the right to return to their homes and land in what became known as the State of Israel in 1948.
My guest is Mazen Kumsia. We're talking about, as you guessed, the Israel-Palestine conflict. Yes, as I mentioned again, is that I've been unable to find any reference in Israeli writings to the Jews from Arab lands as refugees until fairly recently. And they were, in fact, welcomed because after they had driven out the Palestinians and they had a need for cheap labor, they looked to the Jews from Yemen to come in and provide them with cheap labor, and they put them in what they called development towns, and they treated them as second-class citizens because the racism of European Jews was extended to dark-skinned Jews from the Middle East. The Iraqis Jews were very well off, and that's why you mentioned that in order to encourage the Iraqi Jews to come to Israel when they were reluctant to do so, that the Mossad planted bombs in cafes and synagogues, and this was actually reported in the Israeli press back in the 50s. So that story has been so distorted by the pro-Israel propagandists in this country that there's no even debate on it. Described as more or less the equivalent of Palestinians who were forced out. And it's interesting, Rabbi Meir Kahane was the first person to talk about it being a transfer of population. So I'm glad you brought up those points about the illegitimacy of these Jews from Arab lands being considered refugees.
Yes, indeed. And one last thing I want to say about the issue of refugees. Palestinians who were made refugees in 1948, they come from 530 Palestinian villages and towns that were depopulated and completely wiped off the face of the map. The United Nations took the humanitarian aspects of this under its rule, but they did not apply the international law, which is the protection and insistence on their right to return to their homes and lands. This is because of the veto of the United Nations resolutions on this issue by the United States, when most of the countries in the world, with exception, of course, with Israel and the United States, and sometimes three tiny islands that are dependent on the United States, Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and Palau. Those five countries, basically, the U.S., Israel, and those three islands, vote one way, and the rest of the world votes another way. But because the U.S. has a veto power at the United Nations, they can prevent international law from being applied here. And this is unfair, of course, but that's the reality of the misuse of American power to serve a tiny minority interest, being the Zionists, rather than serve what is right, what is just, and what the U.S. government many times speaks about, which is human rights and democracy. But they speak about it, but they don't implement it.
I should mention the last president to support the Palestinian right of return was President Kennedy. That's a resolution 194 of the UN Security Council. And 2 days before he was assassinated, the U.S. representative in the United Nations voted to reaffirm the right of the Palestinians who had been expelled from Palestine to have the choice of returning or being compensated. But they've never been given that choice, and no U.S. president since has suggested that this happened.
Also, the U.S. President Kennedy, if I may supplement this, was the last U.S. president to question Israel or its nuclear program. And he wrote a very strongly worded letter to the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, Shkol, and I have a copy of this letter. And it was very clear that the U.S. will not allow Israel to develop nuclear weapons, and this happened also just before his assassination. And there's a theory about his assassination that has to do with this issue, that if he had not insisted on disarming Israel of its nuclear weapons, he would not have been killed.
I should also mention that he was also making a serious effort to get the Israel lobby at the time, American Zionist Council, to register as a foreign agent, which their lawyers were able to put off until November 22nd, 1963, after which it became moot. I want to bring up the situation in Gaza, which the Israelis left, quote-unquote, Ariel Sharon pulled out in 2005, ostensibly to make sure the West Bank would remain Israeli, but I've also thought it was intended to cause a division within the Palestinian movement, which it has. In a few minutes left, what's your take on the situation now in Gaza, from your perspective, with Hamas, and is it realistic or even desirable to hope that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority collaborate together?
Well, Gaza's situation is, words of the United Nations report recently, is on the verge of a humanitarian catastrophe, if not already a humanitarian catastrophe. Gaza is a strip of land that's a semi-arid region that has 1.5 million Palestinians. Two-thirds of them are refugees from 1948. They live in this impoverished strip of land, which is totally dependent, essentially, on Western and Eastern support from outside, basically. And Israel besieges it, so preventing aid from coming in from the sea or the land entries, and in coordination with the Egyptian government, which unfortunately follows the U.S. and Israel demands to besiege Gaza from the southern end. This has resulted in really a very dramatic increase in infant mortality, in malnutrition, and literally in the deaths of hundreds and perhaps thousands of people because of lack of medical services. And that's not counting the environmental catastrophe that it is, because Israel even prevents sewage treatment facilities from being repaired or fixed in Gaza, and regularly bombs these things, resulting in really a catastrophic situation. Now, having said that, what is happening in terms of the future, and what does it look like? Gaza, of course, has Hamas, which I personally disagree with the philosophy and ideology of Hamas. But nevertheless, it's still an occupied territory. Even the United Nations recognizes it as an occupied territory. It is not under the authority of Hamas, so to speak, because there's no authority in an occupied territory, whether in the West Bank or Gaza Strip. They are under Israeli occupation directly. You can have some administrative aspects that Hamas takes care of in the West Bank, in Gaza, or Fatah takes care of in the West Bank, but ultimately the occupation determines everything. And so the situation in Gaza is that of a large open-air prison camp, except, of course, in a prison you're forced to feed the prisoners. In this case, Israel doesn't have to feed the Palestinian prisoners. So this is what's happening. I hope that Hamas and the Fatah and those Palestinian factions will get their act together and join hands to really do what is needed, which is to resist the occupation and to challenge the occupation and to go to international courts and bring Israeli leaders to The Hague and other international courts as the war crimes and human rights violations that they have engaged in are all basically sanctioned by international law.
Well, I know the United States Obama administration has been very adamant about the Palestine Authority not going to the international court, as if the United States the indispensable nation, we're told, has a right to determine what is lawful and what is not lawful. And in the fact, the United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court because it does not believe Americans can be judged by non-Americans. And this is holding up the one of the negotiations in Afghanistan with the Karzai government because the U.S. demands that American soldiers not be judged by the countries in which they're occupying. The Iraq negotiations broke down because the Iraqi government, whatever one says about it, would not allow the United States soldiers to operate beyond Iraqi laws and not be subject to Iraq laws, and that was the reason the U.S. left Iraq, for no other reason. And this is a problem now in Afghanistan because the Afghani government under Karzai doesn't want to give the United States American military carte blanche and leave it up to the U.S. courts to judge how Afghans are treated by American soldiers. So this probably isn't the same category. Mazen, very quickly, because we're coming to the end of the program, people should go to your website, kumsaya.org. That's the best way to contact you?
Yes, and I'm happy to be in contact with anybody. More importantly, I think people can Google information that we talked about to find out more about these things, and should act by engaging in boycott, divestment, sanctions, which, just like the issues in South Africa under apartheid, the participation of the international community was critical, was important supplement to the resistance on the ground that finally ended that racist apartheid regime that was also, by the way, supported by the U.S. government.
And on that note, Mazen Kumsi, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today and keep up the fight in Palestine. Take care.
Thank you very much.